All right. It is June 2nd, 2019. It's Sunday afternoon, and I am extremely hungover. I want to thank everyone who came out to my 50th birthday bash last night at the Crowbar in Sydney, Australia. Danko Jones was supposed to be there, but his tour's been postponed till September, but we still had a hell of a night. I mean, there's a couple hundred people there. There were several bands, including Fangs, which just really tore up the place, and it was an amazing night. And I do want to thank everyone for attending, and this is going to be a real quick set of upfronts because I just got to get this episode going so I can get back to the couch. Everyone, today we are sharing an interview we had with Matt Sullivan of Light in the Attic Records. Now, for those of you who are unfamiliar with Light in the Attic, go to lightintheattic.net. This is a record label that puts out a lot of really important music from around the world, from various times. They find a lot of recordings that are quite important, but may have not had the attention when they were originally released. They are arguably responsible for the resurgence of artists like Bette Davis and Sugarman Rodriguez. So there we go. Enjoy this week's interview. And don't forget the world's greatest record cleaner, Groove Washer. Go to groovewasher.com, enter promo code VinylGuide10, and you will get 10% off all your record accessories. I love the Groove Washer. I use it daily. However, I'm not using it today because my head friggin' hurts. But every other day, 364 days this year, I will use Groove Washer. Go over to groovewasher.com, the world's greatest record cleaner, 10% off with promo code VinylGuide10. All right, here's our interview with Matt Sullivan of Light in the Attic Records. All right, today on the Vinyl Guide, I'm with Matt Sullivan, founder of Light in the Attic Records. It's a reissue. Is it fair to say Light in the Attic is a reissue label, or do you like to set it up differently, Matt?
Well, most things we've done has been reissues or archival or releases of, you know, first time releases of archival recordings. So I think it's fair to say that. I mean, it's a majority of our catalog, but we have released a number of new artists over the years, and we do a lot of other things. We're a distribution company for about 150 labels, and we do lots of licensing for film and television and all that kind of stuff. So you can call us whatever you like. That's just what I'm trying to say.
Okay, cool. And it is a phenomenal catalog, and the listeners check it out at lightintheattic.net. Now, Matt, I've spent several days reviewing and listening and reading and preparing for the interview, and yet I still feel very underprepared because Light in the Attic has such a vast catalog, and it doesn't seem, at least on the surface, to have a single unified theory that runs through it all. Or does it? Is there something I may be missing there?
No, it probably doesn't. It's a hard thing to kind of put into a quick sentence. When you're sitting next to someone on the airplane, they say, "What do? I confuse them as I confuse my dad when I try to explain it to him." No, it's not. I mean, it's, you know, for us, how cliche it probably sounds, is just finding music and recordings and, you know, artists that we're passionate about who are a bit off the radar, or maybe it's a recording in a catalog that's off the radar. So, you know, we might reissue a Willie Nelson record or a D'Angelo record, or work with Sly Stone uncovering some recordings that maybe haven't been heard. And while all those are household names, we're still passionate about those records and feel like those records need to be back out there, or as well as stories within those records need to be shared and heard, and people need to be educated on why these recordings are important in 2018 or the year we're reissuing them. But also we feel that it's important to shine a light on lesser known artists who we're just as passionate about. So, you know, artists like, you know, Rodriguez or Donnie and Joe Emerson or Lewis, or, you know, the Jamaican community in Toronto that made incredible dub and reggae music in the 60s, 70s and 80s and still does today. So it's pretty vast. I mean, it seems like most labels that do reissues tend to focus either on, you know, reissuing the Beach Boys and the Beatles, or the most esoteric things that there are. And for us, I mean, it's just, you know, we like music, and we like Beach Boys just as much as we like the most obscure garage band that might be amazing from 1957. Yeah. So,
well, what is more difficult, finding good music to reissue or obtaining the rights to reissue it?
Well, by far obtaining the rights. I can find good music to listen to all day. But obtaining the rights is just, it's a continuous nightmare that we face from day to day, but it's what we love, so I'm not complaining. But it's difficult. It's often we're reissuing things that are might be owned by a major label, or an independent label, or an old producer, or the artist, and it's just often difficult to kind of to figure out where those rights reside, and the fact that, you know, maybe contracts don't exist, and you know, and so therefore it's us doing the best due diligence we can to, you know, make things legal and above board, and, you know, pay the royalties to, you know, ideally the artist, but if the artist signed a bad contract, then we might be paying the royalties to, you know, legally whoever owns that master or the publishing rights. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's, you know, in the 16 years we've been doing this, we've learned a lot, but it's every day is a little unique.
So I imagine you got to kiss a lot of frogs before you find the prince. And so you have to listen to a lot of music before you hone in on something that you'd be really interested pursuing. And then I imagine out of 100 pursuits, maybe only a handful of them turn out to be fruitful.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, for us, we have a lot of fires going on at any time. So it's like some reissue we're working on might take like, you know, a year, and other ones might take like 10 years. So you just kind of slowly have to chip away at them, is kind of how it goes. But sometimes they don't work out. And, you know, typically they do, but there's a lot we're just waiting on still.
You're like a detective with a bunch of cold case files, just kind of waiting for a lead to come in. Yeah.
Yeah, or just kind of wait that, like, you know, maybe your hammer, you know, reminding someone every kind of month or 4 or 5 years, like, hey, we'd still love to do this and work with you. And yeah, I mean, every day you wake up and you check your email inbox and you just hope that maybe someone said yes who's been ignoring you for 5 years.
That's a lot like setting up podcast interviews. So so let's talk about a few of those pursuits, because I think those are fascinating. Tell us a few stories about some of the hurdles you had to go through to be able to license some of these records, even successful or unsuccessful ones.
Yeah, they're all unique. I mean, you know, one that we've told a lot that people like to hear about is the Rodriguez records, and those folks down in Australia have mm-hmm. been fans of Rodriguez a lot longer than most of us. That goes with the South Africans as well, of course. Rodriguez was an artist who made some amazing, a couple amazing records in about 1970 and 71 out of Detroit. And we heard a song on a compilation by David Holmes, who's a really amazing producer based in Ireland. And this is maybe the early 2000s, and, you know, we fell in love with the song, and I'm getting the Rodriguez records, and in further falling in love with his music, and, you know, traveling to Detroit, trying to reissue those albums and trying to win him over and getting the producers on board and the old label. And Rodriguez was an artist who'd been, just wasn't paid proper royalties for years. His records, as many listeners might know, had sold a lot of records. And, you know, he hadn't been properly paid for them. And so our hope was, you know, we wanted to put these records out, reissue them, and make sure Rodriguez was paid. And that took a long, 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 long time. You know, through our releases, he was properly paid. And I'm proud of that happened. And, you know, we had been reissuing the records a few years before a movie called Searching for Sugar Man came out. That was about a documentary about Rodriguez that did, you know, really well and kind of catapulted his life, at least, you know, in places outside of Australia and South Africa that didn't know his music much, to a whole other level. So that, you know, it was a process. It was probably like about 3 or 4 years. I mean, other ones we've done, There's so many random ones. I don't
Well, let's stay on Rodriguez for a little bit. So, yeah, obviously the movie Searching for Sugar Man came out, and it was a hit. I'm not sure everyone expected it to be as big as it was, but you're right. It did catapult Rodriguez to the forefront of a lot of music lovers who wouldn't have heard his music previously. And right. You were, I guess, in there beforehand. So you were surfing this wave of Rodriguez mania, yeah?
Yep.
When you go to pursue someone like Rodriguez, you hear the songs, you see there's value there, you reach out to the individual. It takes some time to be able to get them to build that trust for them to be able to share those rights with you, I imagine.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think that's a big thing that we struggle with or something. And it makes sense, you know, often you don't realize that as a listener or just a fan of the music, and you know, you're discovering something for yourself for the first time that's from years and years ago, and you know, you're feeling inspired and loving what you're hearing, and you know, you touch base with the artist or the old label, and maybe they're not as passionate about it, and you know, you're pulling ghosts out of the closet, or you know, bringing up some memories that they're not so inclined to wanting to share, or go back and revisit. So,
and these are people who have probably been repeatedly screwed over by the record business, probably giving the same pitches that you may be giving as well. So, you have that to deal with too.
Yeah, you got that, and you quickly understand why they have their doubts. You know, so you know, and as you mentioned, it takes time to just build up trust. And you know, we are a company that prides ourselves on sending royalty statements and being fair to people, and you know, and being honest and transparent. So, but you know, calling up these people, they don't know us from Adam. So,
right.
Yeah, it takes time to kind of to get there. I mean, one project in particular might be my favorite thing we've ever released. Is this? It's a double LP. Sorry. Triple LP and double CD and digital release of a compilation called Native North America Volume 1. And it's recordings of Native Americans and First Nations and Inuit people in the regions of Canada, Alaska, and some of the northern U.S. states doing folk, rock, and country music in the 19 kind of late 60s to mid 80s. And that project came about through a friend of ours and a kind of music historian, record collector, and DJ named, he goes by Cipriano. His real name is Kevin Howes. He actually coincidentally wrote the liner notes for the Rodriguez releases. And Kevin is just an incredible record collector and music head. And he was spending about a decade driving across kind of Canada and, you know, the upper U.S. states, northern states, you know, going to Native American reservations and First Nation reservations and museums and community centers, looking for kind of, slowly he was finding these 45 RPM singles and LPs and such of this music being recorded, and was for, you know, he's, you know, a mid-40s white guy, you know, who was not familiar with this music because a lot of it hadn't been documented. I mean, some of the, you know, Link Wray and Buffy St. Marie, there has been some, you know, number of very notable musicians who broke out of the, you know, who were Native American and broke out into the music world. But a lot of these recordings did not, that we focused on. And so Kevin, you know, talking about the difficulties of gaining people's trust, spent, like I said, I mean, it was into, you know, 10, 11 years on this project of, you know, visiting these artists and finding them. I mean, artists who lived, you know, 1,100 miles north of Montreal, like, you know, and, you know, almost like when you look in on Google Street View, it's like, you know, it's like, it looks like Antarctica with a few houses on a hill. So, you know, this music was just like incredibly beautiful and touching. I mean, a lot of it lyrically is about, you know, social commentary and issues within the Native communities, and you know, and a lot of the songs about the environment, and a lot of some songs were in Native languages and some were in English as well.
So when you're talking about someone like, let's say, Rodriguez or Betty Davis, who are potentially reclusive or maybe not as cooperative as other artists, at least you know who to approach, who to, you know, to go to be able to make your pitch. But when you're talking about trying to find the creators of what I assume to be private press records of Native America that were 40 years ago or so, where do you even begin? How do you even know that these people are around? Or if you cannot find them, can you proceed?
A lot of it is, you know, we've been really blessed to have people like Kevin Howe, Cipriano, I mentioned in our lives, who are these, mm-hmm. you know, passionate music experts who have turned us on to a lot of records, you know, that we didn't know. So a lot of times, or often, we are, you know, those people who've done a lot of their due diligence and research, kind of open doors for us. Like maybe they've already, you know, made some of the connections, but, often it's just hard. It's like, you know, looking at a 45 label and, you know, maybe there's a YouTube link, maybe there's not, could start there. Who knows these days? But if it's not, it usually starts with a collector who has the 45 mm-hmm. and then they share a YouTube link with us. And from that point, you know, what's on the 45 label? What was the label? Was it a one-off label? Was it a label that released a number of things? What else was on the label? You know, are there other kind of like jumping off points, maybe the pretty notable name, where was it recorded, if we can know. So it's like, you know, going to the, you know, the music unions and finding old, you know, I mean, most of these private press recordings, of course, were not union sessions. So therefore, that doesn't help, you know, was there a publisher, you know, was the stuff registered on ASCAP, BMI, or, you know, CSAC or SOCAN, or, you know, any of the right societies around the globe, you know, typically these things might even register at once, but actually usually the super private press stuff never really was registered. And so it's a battle to kind of figure out from that standpoint where to go from. Of course, I mean, we've been doing this since about 2001, and you know, the internet as a tool to help find people and just share music is, of course, like, you know, is a whole other incredible tool now than it was even in 2001. So finding people, you know, has been incredibly helpful through the web, you know, Facebook, et cetera. You kind of forget just how many of us are on there, who all over the world. And, you know, you forget sometimes that people aren't on there, which is, makes it hard, but sometimes kind of refreshing. But I'd say Native North America for us has been kind of one of the hardest projects, but also one of the ones that we're probably most proud of. It just like musically, I think it really speaks volumes of what's going on in the current climate of the world. And it is just, it's beautiful, but also it's a lot of the stories that have come with that have been like, has been very inspiring.
So you find a record, or you get turned on to a record that's 40 years old. You track down the individual who recorded it in Bismarck, North Dakota, or wherever. You're finally able to locate them or their family, obtain the rights to be able to release it. Now, what happens when you need to find the tapes? Because I imagine taking the sound off an old 45 isn't ideal. What are some of the stories or adventures you've had in trying to locate the master tapes?
It can be really incredibly difficult to find tapes. The reality of it is that often, you know, especially the records we're reissuing, is that tapes don't exist. You know, they did at one point, but I'd say often for our things, there's a lot of things we do come from tapes. But when you get deep into the private press sector, like the Native North America stuff, it's kind of a miracle that, you know, some of these recordings are even, you know, they're even being heard.
Right.
So, you know, it's definitely a battle of that in that sense. So, you know, I want to say on Native North America, yeah, we do our best, like in that sense, to try to find tapes. And if we don't find tapes, then pretty much we do our best to try to find a number of copies of the vinyl, if that's going to be the best source. You know, in the case of Native North America, it was the best source that's available, I should say. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of weigh the options, like, you know, is if the source is so bad, you know, maybe it's not worth putting out. Like if there's like 50 copies that were ever pressed and we can only find two of them and they're beat to hell. But we've never been in that sense. I mean, we have really, really, really good mastering engineers who spend a lot of time on getting excellent transfers and restoring the audio and spending months on things that most people would probably spend 2 seconds on. Mm-hmm. That's really important for us. And, you know, we do our best. You know, I hope that people, you know, understand, I mean, and not that everyone is going to, but just a lot of time goes into that. And that's like an important piece of the puzzle, of course. But we've had things like, you know, the Lee Hazelwood catalog. We've been reissuing a lot of the Lee Hazelwood archive through Lee's family. Excuse me. Lee Hazelwood was a really incredible music producer, songwriter, you know, from about the 1950s up until death a few years ago. He did These Boots Are Made for Walking with Nancy Sinatra, for those that aren't familiar with Lee. And, you know, that catalog we licensed, he had a label called LHI, Lee Hazelwood Industries, from 66 to 71. They had about 18 LPs and 70 or so 45s. And that record, we, I'm sorry, not the record, that catalog, we spent about a year or two trying to find tapes, and his wife told us, it's after looking everywhere, his wife told us, well, maybe, you know, try to give the publisher a call. Maybe they'll have some tapes. And we'd reach out to the publisher and a number of his publishers, and, you know, they ended up having the tapes super organized in the back room of their office, and they'd been sitting there for about 40 years. Mm-hmm. And they had, you know, 450 reels of tape. So we transferred nearly 300 of them.
Now you had another problem, too much tape.
Too much tape, but it was incredible. I mean, there was like, you know, multi-tracks, unreleased stuff. And I mean, it was mind-boggling. So we picked out, you know, the stuff we knew we wanted to release, and then transferred a bunch of stuff. We found, like, we just put out this great unreleased record that Lee did under the band name The Woodchucks. From 1964, it was an unreleased surf record with some just killer musicians. 63, 64, we believe recorded in L.A. At United Recorders, but we're not 100% sure. And that was in the archive, you know, this like unreleased, just, you know, on tape, the unreleased, you know, insane surf record, you know, doing like Quiet Village and a bunch of, you know, kind of classic surf songs, but also some originals. And, you know, that's that. I mean, Lee was such a master of recording and the production elements that, like, you know, a record like that with tape, and we press it at RTI. I was so happy how that turned out. Mm-hmm. So it's all different. I mean, you know, often with major labels, they'll, you know, if they have tapes, they'll help provide tapes. It's just, it's always different. I mean, we work hard to find the best source. Sometimes we might be doing a record from the 90s and that, you know, the source is DAT, you know, that's what they recorded on. And mm-hmm. maybe we've done prior press records where there never was vinyl, you know, the artist recorded at home on a cassette and that's the source.
So for obviously Lee Hazelwood, you were able to find this treasure trove of tapes and go straight to the source. And it's very, very fortunate that that occurred. But then you go to someone like, say, D'Angelo or the Stone Roses. Now, these are modern in comparison to a lot of the catalog. I imagine the companies that owned the rights to D'Angelo, Stone Roses, etc., they still are in business. They still have an interest in pressing these things. Why was Light in the Attic chosen to release these above the existing company or the rights holder?
Well, they're all unique. I mean, in the case of the Stone Roses, that record had never been reissued in America. And I think to the rights holders of that record in America, they just had bigger fish to fry, which for me, mm-hmm. you know, it was a blessing because we just love that record. But, you know, for them, I mean, I get it. I mean, they have, you know, they're a giant corporation, a major label. And, you know, Stone Roses being from England, who were a much more famous group there, the record had been reissued to death over there as well as other places. In the case of D'Angelo, you know, we reissued that record before he did the Black Messiah record as his latest album, which now at this point is a few years ago. So we came at a point when the label here didn't care about Voodoo, at least on vinyl, I should say. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I hope that the majors, I mean, I think they do. They have faith in what we do and that we're going to put the extra time into it. You know, D'Angelo came with some great liner notes written by Jason King, who's the I think he's the head of the music department at the Clive Davis music department at NYU in New York. And he spent, you know, months on these liner notes interviewing, you know, Pino Palladino and all the session players and, you know, Questlove, and like really getting into kind of the backstory of that record, which, you know, hadn't been told in that type of depth outside of his notes. So, you know, I think the majors, you know, knew that we were going to put in the extra care into that. And, you know, and sometimes for them, depending on what it is, it might seem like a big artist, but maybe it's not in this territory. I mean, you know, like Serge Gainsbourg is a good example. We've been reissuing some of his records now for over a decade, and he has a record called My French is so bad, but so sorry for your listeners who speak French. History de Melody Nelson from 1970-71 or so. And, you know, that record's a big record in France. I mean, at this point, it's become a pretty big cult classic, but when we started trying to reissue that record over a decade ago, you know, the major label in the U.S., you know, didn't care about it, and they've been happy with our sales, and, you know, they you know, again, they have bigger fish to fry. So I feel lucky, fortunate when it goes that way. And, you know, sometimes it doesn't. It's often a struggle. I mean, there's so many more reissue labels now than there used to be when we started, you know, it's 16 or so years ago.
On that topic, what makes Light in the Attic unique in this field of multiple reissue labels? Why do artists go to Light in the Attic?
Why do artists go to Light in the Attic, or why do listeners, or what?
Well, listeners, I mean, you've got this catalog that is quite vast. If you have Betty Davis and I'm looking for Betty Davis, I'm going to go to whoever's selling Betty Davis. Right. So, but more the artists.
I feel that, not to sound egotistical, but I feel that, you know, an artist or a musician who really likes, I guess, pure music is how I kind of say it. I think they would respect Light in the Attic and respect the care that goes into it, and see kind of, you know, the depth of the liner note to the care we put into, you know, restoring audio. And also, like, we're not looking for a quick buck. You know, we're genuinely passionate about these records. I mean, everyone who works at Light in the Attic, the 15 or so of us in Seattle and Los Angeles at our two label offices, you know, all of us are just freaks for records and music in any format. If it's heavy metal or, you know, folk music or, you know, Latin music and all types of things. So I'd hope, you know, artists, you know, see that. And the artists we deal with, I mean, you know, the Sly Stones or the Betty Davises or, you know, Donnie and Joe Emerson or, you know, Kris Kristofferson. I think these people can see what we do and see that we're going to put the care into these things. And, you know, a lot of times, as you were mentioning earlier, just about the, a lot of these artists, especially the lesser known ones who didn't make it, you know, they're dealing with a lot. They've had 40 years of bad, you know, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, 50 years of bad experiences in the music business. So once we do gain their trust, I think they're kind of surprised at, like, wow, you know, this did turn out pretty great. And, I didn't get ripped off. Okay. And, you know, there's a positive thing here. I mean, that's our hope at the end of the day is, you know, yes, we want to sell records and can, you know, we're a business and need to keep that going and all that. But our hope at the end of the day is just at the very least, this recorded document can finally kind of be, presented in the fashion it originally should have been presented in, meaning, you know, context and liner notes and just like a marketing campaign and just like care and detail and love that went into it.
I would agree. Whenever I get a Light in the Attic release, and I've had a handful of them now, and they seem very well curated. There's a lot of care that goes into them. For example, the Hayes McMullen set. Through that and just seeing the book, I can't imagine that there would be so much care, so much information and detail that went into creating this package. And I have no idea how many you sold, but I felt an instant connection with the music. And with the other Light in the Attic releases, it's very similar. Now, it also seems to me that being the owner of a record label is a precarious situation, especially when you're putting that sort of detail and care and you have that sort of quality ethos. Have you ever gone forward and released something that you were sure isn't going to recoup, you were sure you were going to struggle with?
Yeah, I mean, quite often. The fact that, like, I mean, a lot of these releases, you know, we're reissuing a Stone Roses record, a Willie Nelson record, you know, you have a pretty good idea, like, okay, maybe this won't go crazy, but we're going to sell, you know, a few thousand copies or something. But, you know, when you talk about Hayes McMullen or Native North America or even Rodriguez when we first did it or Betty Davis when we first did it, I mean, those artists didn't have, and some still don't, some giant cult following. So you just don't know what to expect. I mean, you know, you hope that it's at least at a minimum going to kind of hit a spark with folks like you that, you know, really care and get it. But, you know, our hope is always it branches out and gets more people excited about it. Often it's a case like, you know, we'll put stuff out and think, God, hopefully we don't lose our ass on this, but, you know, we'll just have to wait and see how it goes. I mean, Hayes McMullen, you know, we didn't sell a lot of copies of that. And to hear what you just said about it makes me feel so happy about it because I cared so much about that. And, you know, Eric and Danny and Gail Dean Wardlow who helped put the thing together and, you know, a number of other people. I mean, we all, you know, and Hayes' family, I mean, it meant the world to us. But, like, you know, I still feel like that record hasn't made the impact it should have, even though it did get really good reviews and it was in some great places. But, you know, it's been a year and a half since that came out. And it is funny with these releases is, you know, we've had releases that didn't do anything at all. And then 10 years later, it ends up in some movie or in some, someone samples it or just someone talks about it. And all of a sudden it has this whole other light, whole other, you know, the reissue being 10 years ago, the second chance, it has now a third chance and kind of gets out there. So it's, you know, I'm still hoping with Hayes that, like, you know, it's not over. Thank you for what you said.
No worries. Look, well, it's the absolute truth. And it seems to me that a lot of this product, I mean, Hayes McMullen is probably a bad example of this because it was never released initially. A lot of these artists and these recordings were released in the past and weren't commercially successful. And people around them, you know, no one's jumping to claim credit for something that wasn't a huge success. And then you guys are, again, taking a second chance on it, or as you say, possibly a third, and putting a lot of care into it, perhaps giving it the environment and the treatment that it should have gotten, and then just really throwing a Hail Mary pass and hoping that it lands in the right hands.
Right. No, that's the hope. that's what happens, and the hope is that it someone catches the Hail Mary, which isn't always the case.
Or at least not yet on some of them. Yeah. It takes time. Now, you formed the label in 2001, arguably just before the height of P2P and file sharing. How did you navigate those waters? And what is your opinion, your thought, your strategy maybe on today's environment of streaming and digital access? And is it better now than it was when you first started the label?
I don't know. I guess it depends. In my mind, sometimes I say yes and often I say no. I mean, there's more as a listener and a music lover. It's just mind boggling how much music's at your fingertips with, you know, the Spotify and the YouTubes and the Apple Music and all these places in the world. So I think that's incredible. But I think it is in many ways, it can be more difficult to make a living. I feel like the vinyl industry, or however you want to say it, feels very oversaturated where there's just so many releases, and I guess it doesn't really come down just to vinyl. It's pretty much any format. I guess it comes also down to TV shows now and Donald Trump and everything else. It's hard to kind of find a moment to peace and quiet to kind of focus on really what you want to listen to or how you want to spend your time. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I mean, we do a lot in the digital space, and like that is, you know, obviously that's how a lot of people listen to music, but we still do some CDs and we still do, you know, vinyl is definitely a key passion of the label, and that will continue. But, you know, as I mentioned, we do a lot of sync licensing. I mean, like there's 8 of us at the LA office, four of which just do licensing for film, television, original songs for advertisements and that kind of stuff. And we, you know, do that for loads of other labels and stuff. And, you know, that's become an integral part of our business, as well as distributing, you know, so many different labels. So it's definitely a completely different world now. And it's just a short time. I feel like even the last like 3 or 4 years has become a completely different world.
Well, you were gleaning on there. And if I got this right, it's really more of a change of the behavior of how people consume music. People don't necessarily indulge themselves with a full side, not even just a full album, a full side of an album. It's very momentary and very mobile. It's got to be very convenient and very quick. But at the same time, you know, your business is evolving to look at different opportunities, you know, like you say, the music license for movies and TV and that sort of thing. So do you believe the current format of the album, we'll say vinyl, but really the long play album, is that a sustainable format for the future?
I mean, we don't deal with a lot of contemporary recordings and releases. So I don't know. I mean, I think it depends who you're talking to. If it's like a kid who's 12 years old just getting into music, like I don't know how much they're into albums as well as just singles through Spotify and YouTube. I mean, more YouTube than Spotify. But for me, I mean, personally, I you know, the album format is just, I love it. And that's not going anywhere for me. But I mean, there are a lot of young people buying records, you know, clearly. So, and those people buying records, I mean, are buying a record because they must like the album format. So I guess it just depends, like on a mainstream level, it is kind of interesting to think in, you know, 30 years are the Katy Perrys of the world going to be releasing albums? I mean, probably not. Who knows what they're going to be releasing?
It's arguable they release them now.
Yeah, and it's also just, but also just in terms of even just in a digital space, will they be released? Yeah, I mean, it will be just singles, or, you know, I mean, could it get any worse? I don't know, but it's musically speaking, but it depends who you're talking to. So, you know, I'm 42 years old and feel like I'm 960 years old in this kind of space sometimes, when those types of questions, which is it's a really good question, and I often wonder about it. But I feel confident and know that there's not, you know, that people, there's still going to be people out there like me and you that are going to, you know, enjoy the album format and like vinyl for, you know, I think a long time, if not forever.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure I'm going to last forever, but hopefully the format will continue. People,
your records will last forever, though. Records will last forever.
Quite possibly, hopefully. I've spent enough on them. I hope they do. So what's the big fear for a record label these days? And what's the potential industry disruptors that are coming?
Well, I mean, you know, you have the disrupt. If you're trying to sell vinyl and you're not really aggressive or creative in the digital space, then, you know, that digital space, meaning, you know, YouTube and whatever else, is a potential disruptor for you. I mean, there's so many factors of just like, I feel like more so now than 10 years ago for us, it's just like not putting all our eggs in one basket has really kept us here. So like, you know, we've been early on, you know, in year two or probably one or two of Light in the Attic, we had trouble getting anyone to distribute us. And so we realized through an internship I did in the mid-90s at a label called Munster Records in Spain, who did lots of reissues, we realized you need distribution to survive. But realizing for us that it was, you know, selling direct to stores was so key. So we ended up kind of finding labels that had a similar aesthetic or ethos that we did, and made our catalog bigger and then started selling direct to stores, you know, all over the world, as well as, you know, as well as distributors who, you know, we got our catalog grew and we started getting distributors. But, you know, we sell direct to, you know, over 300 record stores, and then have, you know, non-exclusive distribution in the States and distributors all around the globe who get us in, you know, a lot of other places. But for us, that's what I'm trying to say is just, I don't know if it's diversifying or what, but like not putting all of our eggs in just this one specific release, or, you know, just in terms of digital or vinyl or distribution or sync licensing. Like, we really try to like keep everything pretty wide and do our best with everything. I mean, we often feel as an independent business, you know, being stretched thin, but.
So yeah. You've protected yourself quite well and credit your business sensibilities there to be able to remain diversified. But potential industry disruptors, things that are coming up, 3D printing, what are the concerns of a record label owner about the future?
I mean, you ask, it's a good question. I don't know. I guess I should probably spend more time thinking about 3D printing and things like that. I guess quite often it's hard to kind of look forward as much as that. You know, I don't know. I feel good about what we're doing and as a company and the music we're releasing, and just kind of keep pushing on that and finding really creative, interesting projects. And just, you know, I mean, again, continuing to evolve in our space, you know, in terms of business, I would say, you know, again, you know, strengthening our distribution model, you know, year after year, which we have, and, you know, we, you know, having deeper relationships with the Spotify's of the world and those types of places is, you know, more important now than ever has been before.
Sorry, I don't mean to ruin your weekend or anything asking these
things. No, you're not at all. You're not at all. I mean, I think like 3D printing and those types of things are fascinating. I just honestly don't know that much about it. And, you know, hopefully I won't eat my words on that one day. You know, I mean, it's interesting with like music now. It's like, you know, I feel, as I mentioned, Donald Trump and all the other stuff, it just becomes constantly bombarding us as media. It's hard to find the time, but I do feel that there now or in 100 years or whenever there is a value in the world for people who like music, for things like Light in the Attic, or, you know, your older brother who turned you on to music, or sister, or, you know, the guy down at the record store who, you know, took a liking to you and showed you, you know, the Dead Boys or Pavement or Run DMC or whatever it is. Like, I think like those types of eye-opening experiences are important. So I feel like with Light in the Attic, wherever we may reside in the future, you know, there'll be a place for us if it is 3D printing or whatever it is, you know, to help kind of curate that space or help push people in the right direction. I mean, that's our hope, is that people bought Rodriguez or Karen Dalton or Betty Davis or whatever it might be, and they, you know, see the logo on the back of the record, and then they go to the store a few years later and they see, you know, Hayes McMullen, and they just, wow, that was Light in the Attic, I like that one, and they have faith that we're gonna give them something worth their money.
So right now, Light in the Attic relies very heavily on the online sales as well as distribution. You also have recently opened up your own shop. What percentage of each of those contributes to the sales of Light in the Attic?
I wish I had that handy. We've had the store in Seattle for a number of years. And about 2 years ago, we moved into this great new space called the KXP Gathering Space, which is part of KXP, a phenomenal independent radio station in Seattle. I'm sorry. I don't know.
That's okay.
I don't know the numbers. I mean, I can tell you that, you know, for us, physical, you know, physical sales, meaning LPs and some CDs are, you know, that's more of our revenue than the digital space at this point. I don't know if that doesn't totally answer your question though. Physical, you're asking more of distribution sales, meaning direct to retail versus our website?
Without getting too in-depth, the reason I bring that, I mean, right now as we talk, your website is offline. It's experiencing some difficulty. Is that making you sweat? Is that something?
It fortunately, we have a good web person. It doesn't happen often, but it does happen. It has happened before. It makes me sweat, but it's not our key point of sale. Selling direct to stores and distributors around the world is. But our website, I mean, the sales just keep growing up and growing up, going up. Especially considering we distribute so many labels. So it's there's so many titles. I mean, the distribution is primarily based out of our Seattle office. My business partner, Josh Wright, oversees that part of the business, and I'm based here at our Los Angeles office. So I often am learning about the distribution side of the business through our email newsletter and our Instagram social posts and seeing it on the website. So I love a lot of the titles, but it's hard to keep up. There's so much good material.
With a physical presence, you're able to play the music and get people excited about it. Not so much with a website or if you're distributing things to stores across the country. The product like Betty Davis, Lee Hazelwood, I think that comes with its own cachet and can generate some of its own excitement. But how do you get someone on the other side of the country or even the other side of the world excited about someone like Louis L'Amour or some of the other artists, maybe some of the international artists that you distribute?
It's hard. It's a constant challenge for all of us here. It tends to be just, publicity. We work with a number of really great publicists around the globe, and a number of our distributors have really good in-house publicity departments. So that might be our maybe our distributor in Germany with a great publicist. But a lot of it's, social media and giving people context, and it's a struggle in the fact that, you can't win them all. You hope you can. I mean, I feel like at the very least, the records have been back out there and documented and archived in a way that I feel like is positive, and we're proud of. But, it's a hard thing. I mean, trying to get these songs on Spotify playlists and trying to educate, the Spotify editors that, they should place these songs on playlists has a lot to do. Did we get a sync license on it? Did someone sample it? Did it get a write-up in the New York Times or on Pitchfork or Mojo? And, so a lot of it's hammering away at all those areas, and, hopefully we get that sync license, or hopefully we get that Mojo review that's a gushing five, star reissue of the month, and then it snowballs in a record store, see it. And a lot of the records we do, I mean, you mentioned L'Amour, and I think earlier we were talking Donnie and Joe Emerson, I mentioned, and a lot of these releases are kind of somewhat of a blank canvas. So it's definitely, the work is in our court to give people that context in 2018 or the year we're reissuing it, I always say, of why anyone should care. And it is weird. I mean, I think previously I said about, we've had records where it'll be very quiet, and then literally 5-10 years go by and, Kanye West samples it, or in some giant TV commercial, or just, a contemporary artist covers a song from it, or it's a strange kind of, they're all unique.
So following your example, when Kanye West or someone like that does sample material, you get a phone call. Is there a set rate? How does that conversation go?
Yeah, they tend to be a lawyer or someone in the business affairs department at one of those record labels, tends to be a major label, and they reach out through our website. People will contact us, or sometimes by phone. More often, it seems like email is the thing these days, and it'll be a business affairs person or a lawyer attorney at a major record label. And, they'll clarify that we have the rights to, third party licensing, meaning to license those masters or publishing, whatever it might be, for usage in a sample. And then once we clarify that, they'll give us like a kind of a deal memo or licensing proposal with terms of, you know, advances and royalties and, you know, years and in perpetuity or however it's going to be. And then, you know, we go through it with over here and, you know, often get our attorney or a sample.
So that starts the negotiation. So that it is a back and forth. They may say, well, we want, you know, in perpetuity, 1 cent per copy. And you'll say, wait a minute, that's the sample that they used is much, you get to hear the songs in advance and then determine that starts the conversation.
Yeah. We also often hire depending on how big the sample is, meaning not the usage, meaning, well, it could be the usage, but I'm referring more to like, is it Kanye West or is it Joe Blow? If it is something of sizable artists that could potentially a lot of revenue, then we'll hire like a sample clearance professional, meaning someone who knows the sample business in and out and can listen to a song and tell you what percentage you should be asking for depending on the usage. Is it, you know, listening to it, is that sample 20% of the new use, meaning the new song? Is it 90%? Is it 50%? And that really helps kind of gauge like what financially should be requested or what's fair. Mm-hmm. Honestly, 9 out of 10 times when people come to us and try to clear a sample, usually it's a low ball offer. So
sure.
It's, you know, the nature of the business. So it's an uphill climb from there. It usually starts there. And then from that, you know, it's just the negotiation process, which can be timely.
Yeah. I suppose it also has to do whether it's the main hook to a well-known song. If someone wanted to sample the main riff to Sugar Man, that's a different cost than a deep cut.
And that's the same thing in terms of not just sampling, but also like usage in TV commercials or TV shows. It's like, if it's something that we get a lot of requests for, it's, you know, can ask for more money than something that's a little more off the radar.
With the cost of being able to produce a documentary really dropping over the last decade or two, you have this research into artists like Rodriguez and Betty Davis and the like. And I imagine those are huge advantages for your label. You have someone like Rodriguez and Betty Davis, and then all of a sudden they have this second or third life kind of put into their catalog. Do you have visibility into when that sort of magic is coming together?
Sometimes, but quite often not. I mean, in terms of Rodriguez, you know, we licensed or tried to start working on those reissues in, I don't even know, 2005 or something like that. And then, you know, finally got the license maybe 2007 or maybe 2007, I think it was. And the reissues finally started coming out in 2008. So, and we didn't hear about the film until, I want to say 2008 or something. I remember meeting the director of Searching for Sugar Man, Malik Benjaloo, at Joe's Pub when we brought Rodriguez out there to play like his first ever kind of real New York show, at least in a zillion years. And Malik was there working on the film, and he seemed really together with everything. But I was thinking, God, how is someone going to make a film on Rodriguez? There's like nothing to pull from. There's no footage. There's, you know, of course, he proved me wrong. But yeah, I mean, sometimes, you know, you can see it coming a little, but, you know, in that case, I think no one expected it to end up where it was. And, you know, someone like Betty Davis, I mean, you know, her thing has been more of this kind of steady climb. It hasn't, you know, I think the Rodriguez case is pretty much kind of one in a million, where it was so, once that film came out, it was kind of a 6 month period where it really just kind of exploded. You know, Betty's had this kind of, you know, natural, you know, climb of her music, or people just kind of have slowly gravitated towards it. But every year seems to be building more on the previous.
So in that 6 month period where the Rodriguez product was selling really heavily, are you having difficulty at times keeping enough stock available, especially with the rumors or the stories of record pressing plants being so busy they can't get to all the jobs, not enough pressing plants around the world? Are you finding that?
Yeah, I mean, it goes in waves. I mean, we struggle with those at times. I mean, there are a lot of pressing plants out there that you mentioned, and so many more popping up. Patrick over here is just at the Making Vinyl Conference. Patrick's the project manager at Lightning Eye, Patrick McCarthy. He was just at the Making Vinyl Conference in Detroit a couple weeks ago and met a lot of great people. It seemed like he met a lot of the new plants popping up in North America, like I want to say four or five in the next like year. Yeah, I mean, the process of like especially putting something out, and then especially especially if it's something that's not Betty Davis or Lee Hazelwood, where it's a bit of a known cult artist, where we have a better gauge of like how many to press. So when we put something out that's a fairly unknown artist or release, we rarely overpress. We always prefer to underpress because we never want to sit on records. And it's that fine thing. It's that fine line of like, oh, we press 1,000 or 2,000 initially, and they sell out fairly quickly. And you're like, gosh, we would have only pressed another 200 or 300. It would have kind of lasted us for a while and been able to kind of continue the thing to build. But to press just 200 or 300 on a repress just financially doesn't, it rarely makes much sense. Mm-hmm. So then we'll kind of have to sit tight to see how the interest builds. And then, we might have to do it. Well, if the interest isn't as much as we thought, then maybe there never is a repress, or maybe there's a repress in 2 years or 3 years. I feel like that's the hardest thing of what we do, is gauging how many to press off the bat. And again, for us, being conservative is the best. But it's frustrating. You work on a record for like 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 years, and then you finally get it out, and you underpress by like 500 units. It's hard. It's like you could repress 1,000 units, and then like literally be excited that 200 go out and sell through in the next couple months, and then the rest of the 800 you're sitting on for like 3 years, and they cost you like maybe with royalties and everything else, over $10 to make. Those 800 units at $10 a piece, you're just like pretty much paying rent on $8,000 that you could have in the bank, but you're putting into something else. Right. So that's always like a hair pulling scenario.
If you end up under pressing, that also creates a value sometimes greater than what they originally were. Does Light in the Attic have rare records that are going for maybe not absurd amounts, but surprisingly high amounts on the secondary market?
Yeah, there's some I occasionally will hear about and then go to Discogs and kind of get a laugh from, but I haven't looked for a while. I'm trying to think of one off the top of my head, and I'm forgetting. I mean, usually the first pressing of something we put out, like a certain, limited color that was 200 copies or came with a 7-inch or something, might be more valuable than the ones that came next, of course, how those things go. But those things are kind of funny to see.
With the shop that you have, the physical shop, the brick and mortar shop, aside from hopefully a profitable revenue stream, what else does that shop bring to the label?
I mean, a number of things, like Seattle and Los Angeles being our home bases. It's great to have just a physical brick and mortar, kind of, as you mentioned, people can go to. We do events at the shop sometimes, record signings, because in stores tend to be, we've done some in stores, but there's, KXP, which is the radio station I mentioned, which is right next to the record store. Artists will sometimes do in studios, then walk over and do, a meet and greet at the record shop. But I mean, our record store, I should clarify, we sell not just our records and records distribute, we sell, used records as well as, albums from zillions of other record labels. It's nice to have a presence. I mean, KXP is very supportive, and they have a great base in the States and around the globe online. It's nice that there's somewhere that people can like visit and just learn more about us, other like a physical place people can visit.
Mm-hmm. Can you do like market tests there? Does it provide you an outlet to be able to test out any new product you have coming up?
We never do. I mean, it's not really. There's a turntable there for people, like a listening station, but it's not, it's in a space where it's a really great open space where there's a really nice coffee shop, and then a KXP, as I mentioned, and there's their stage area, and then there's all these tables, and there's all the music you hear in the space is KXP, the radio station. So it's not a place we can kind of play our own records in a test element. So no. Unfortunately for that. But it's just, I don't know. We obviously love record stores, and our store started off with, previously it was at our office in Seattle, which is kind of a couple miles from the record store, the current record store. And the office had this, the office is upstairs and had this walk-in area that was about as big as a bathroom. I mean, maybe it was a little bigger. Maybe it was a 60 square feet or something. I guess it would be a pretty tiny bathroom, but that's what it is. And it had a tall ceiling, and we kind of loved it because we're like, this is kind of the perfect record store because you can't muck it up. There's a lot of space. You have the tall ceilings. So we had a nice, you know, display of the records on the walls. And that's how it started. And then we thought, well, you know, KXP is moving this new space and we wanted to expand. So now the record store is like 180 square feet. So it's really tiny, but it's like, it's laid out really great. A friend of ours made these great kind of custom cabinets for the records, or shelving, I should say. I guess I like small and intimate places like bars and record shops that like just they're done really well, that like you can't muck it up, and it's has a good vibe, as small things often do.
Yeah, nothing could beat a record shop. Look, Matt, thank you so much for joining us here and telling us all about what it's like to run a label like Light in the Attic. I think a lot of us who listen and enjoy and collect records have this fantasy about you know, what it's like to be on the other side of the business and being able to produce some of these records. And of course, like you say, own a record shop and the whole supply chain, which you clearly do. And it's quite fascinating. It sounds like a lot of hard work too. So I'll let you get back to it. Want to remind folks they could check out the Light in the Attic catalog at lightintheattic.net. There's lots of really interesting, diverse music there. You could listen to the bits of it, order it direct from lightintheattic.net, or go to your local record shop and ask for some of these titles. That I'm sure that that helps quite a bit as well. And again, Matt, thank you so much for joining us here on the Vinyl Guide.
I appreciate you having me on. Thanks for your time and thanks for the support.
All right, there we go. Matt Sullivan of Light in the Attic Records. You could find out more about the Light in the Attic catalog at lightintheattic.net. Ask your local record store about these titles as well. Of course, we want to support your local record store as much as possible. However, if your local record store doesn't carry Light in the Attic, or you live somewhere remote where it's a bit more difficult, just go to lightintheattic.net and you could stock up there. All right, well, that's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. This is Nate completely hungover. Such a big night. Again, thank you, everyone, for showing up. That was phenomenal. And I just got to get back to the couch right now and eat a cheeseburger and watch a movie and just veg out. Tomorrow's a big day. Going to take some aspirin. By the way, if you want to help support our podcast, if you want to help fund the aspirin and cheeseburgers I'm consuming today, go over to patreon.com/vinylguide. There you can sponsor this podcast. $2 a month, $5 a month, $10. The sky's the limit, but any amount is certainly appreciated. The patronage is welcomed over at patreon.com/vinylguide. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode, and I'll probably be more chipper then. So until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.